From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Coming up this hour, we'll look at what it takes for a community to heal after a mass shooting. From political leaders of cities impacted by shootings.
We know one thing for sure. When these shooters come into our communities, they don't see Republicans or Democrats. They just kill people, right?
Plus, Massachusetts Congressman Richard Neal on the leadership we need from Washington.
It's time that we found some common ground around background checks, mental health records, registration of what happens at these gun shows.
And how a mother from Sandy Hook learned to forgive the shooter.
I had learned it was possible to forgive Adam Lanza, and that first step was for me to choose to simply let it go.
Forgiveness, healing, and a path forward after mass shootings. Next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. This week, we've been grappling with the aftermath of mass shootings in Dayton and El Paso. At least 31 people were killed. Today, we want to look at what it takes for a community to heal from that type of tragedy, and what, if anything, we can do to help prevent it in the future. Joining me now on the line is Congressman Richard Neal. He represents Massachusetts' 1st District and is the dean of the New England delegation. Representative Neal, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Delighted to be with you.
Congressman, later this hour, we're going to hear from mayors of some cities who have, you know, unfortunate firsthand experience with mass shootings and the process of community healing. We'd like to focus our conversation with you on policy in the wake of this weekend. What leadership do you think is needed from Washington to help America heal and move forward?
Well, I think that it's important to point out that it appears to be certainly a pathology that's associated with these events, and it seems to be isolated young men who perpetrate the horror of these crimes against innocent victims. And when you consider the backgrounds of some of these individuals, they also have an online presence. And I think trying to monitor that online presence that they have when they say or threaten to do something that is deserving of more attention from the FBI or other law enforcement agencies strikes me as being the appropriate response. When you consider this spate of shootings that we've had across the country, they also are more and more targeting what are known as soft targets. Those are places where there will not be a great deal of security. There certainly would not seem to be monitoring of their activities. And I think as part of the national debate here, it's time that we found some common ground around background checks, mental health records, registration of what happens at these gun shows. And I think that in addition to that, clearly, if somebody has a criminal history, then it strikes me as though there ought to be a reasonable response from law enforcement officials in anticipation of what they might request in terms of online military or quasi-military sales.
Representative Neal, you just mentioned background checks. Washington Post reported last night that the president's having private conversations with lawmakers from both parties where he's expressed at least openness to supporting extensive background checks. Do you believe that? And if you do, what would it take to get that through Congress?
Well, there's a piece of legislation that was passed in the House of Representatives that would do precisely that. So I think if the president is serious or he's earnest about this, then I think the opportunity is right in front of us. Ask the Senate to take the legislation as proposed, amended and passed, and put it up on the Senate floor. The majority leader is in charge of the docket as to what takes place on the Senate floor. He sets the schedule every day with virtually no input from the minority. And it strikes me that this could happen in a matter of days, given the president's recent suggestions, which, by the way, have drawn considerable pushback from the National Rifle Association.
Which makes me wonder, can it really happen, Congressman?
That's a great question. And I think that part of the challenge we have here is that when you look at statistical data that indicates that up to 95% of the American people think that there ought to be mental health background checks, it strikes me as though that's not a ladder that's too tall to climb. That reasonable people ought to be able to say that before you can purchase a gun, there ought to be a waiting period. There ought to be a review of criminal history. There ought to be a review as to whether or not there's been evidence of spousal abuse. And I think that in this instance here, criminality is criminality. And if an individual has been involved in a criminality with a gun, that ought to set off a red flag.
So you've talked about some of the policy options there that are, they seem to be more broadly supported across the American public. Let's talk about one that's only supported at a little bit above 50% in a polling, and that's assault weapon bans. According to lawyers for the El Paso shooter's family, the shooter's mother actually called police over concerns that he owned an AK-style rifle, but police said that there was nothing they could do because he was legally allowed to own the weapon. I know you support an assault weapon ban, and President Trump, though, said yesterday, hey, there's no political appetite for that. What's your response to that?
Well, I think that's contrary to what happened when we actually passed an assault weapons ban, and I voted for it. For 10 years, the assault weapons ban was in place, and it worked. And it was allowed to lapse only because Republicans had taken control of Congress. And at the time, the majority leader in the House of Representatives, Tom DeLay, he pushed for letting it lapse. So I think that there is precedent. It was done. Adjustments were made. And if you use the model of what's happened in Massachusetts, it strikes me that, again, this is a reasonable policy. I don't know anybody who's ever said that they need an AK-47 to go hunting on the weekend.
Now, you represent the 1st District, though, which includes Springfield, home of the gun manufacturer Smith & Wesson. Any gun control legislation, obviously there's some risk that it could end up negatively impacting some of your constituents who maybe work for the company. How do you manage that tension or reconcile that as we have conversations on gun control?
Well, I think that the many police organizations across the country, they use Smith & Wesson weapons. The military uses Smith & Wesson weapons. I mean, there is no argument here on my behalf that we should be taking guns away from those who use it for target practice, those that use it for hunting, those who are gun collectors. And in fact, I think that those are all reasonable parts of the argument, but we're not suggesting that. What we're suggesting is that every opportunity that has availed itself to talk about even the most minor incursion into the gun rights industry, you will hear the NRA, not necessarily these companies, but the NRA will say, oh, that's a step in the wrong direction, that this will invite more monitoring, more control of these industries. And I think that the assault weapons ban, as I noted, that was in place for 10 years, did not do that.
Okay, before we move on, there are some other things I want to ask you about. I just want to ask one more time. Something like an assault weapons ban, yes, it passed in 94, but as you say, it was gone after 2004. What would it take to get something like that passed again now, and is that even possible?
Well, I think that the second part of your question is probably the more accurate one. I think it would be very difficult to do right now. I think that certainly Republicans in the Senate have been hostile to any sort of gun measures, and I think it would be difficult even in some parts of the House of Representatives. But we should not miss the point that the assault weapons ban worked, and I hope that that will be part of any eventual conversation.
One more thing on that. Critics say that the distinctions that make an assault weapon are arbitrary. You know, is it scope? Is it pistol grip? You know, specific characteristics, then therefore an overall ban doesn't make sense. Do you think that that's a fair criticism?
Well, I mean, I think that there's all sorts of nuance that you can add to these arguments. But in fact, the argument that prevailed from 94 to 204 seemed to be entirely workable.
All right. You are the chair of the House Ways and Means Committee, and you've been leading there in some other areas. I'd like to change our focus. Your committee sued the IRS and the Treasury Department over their refusal to turn over 6 years of President Trump's tax returns. Why is this worth litigating through the courts? And what do you say to those who say, listen, this tax returns thing, this is just politics. Cut it out.
Well, there's ample precedent for this, as we established 2 weeks ago. In 1969, the chairman of the Joint Tax Committee actually used Section 1603 to secure copies of President Nixon's tax forms. And the last eight presidents, including Richard Nixon, because there is a qualifying exception there, that Nixon subsequently did voluntarily release his forms, and all presidents since have released their forms to the public. What we're suggesting here is that we are interested in the policy side of this matter. We want to know how, in fact, presidential tax returns are audited. This seems to be a dark space. There's very little knowledge of it. We're told that it happens, and all we're suggesting through oversight responsibility is we'd like to know how it happens.
If President Obama had not released his tax returns, Representative, would you have taken the same steps?
Not only would I have, the Republicans were in control of Congress at the time. You could be sure they would have. I think the evidence is pretty clear on that. But I do think that when you suggest that every president has voluntarily submitted their tax forms for review, I think that's the better argument, if this could have been done on a voluntary basis. And recall that at least three times during the presidential campaign and once as president, that Donald Trump has suggested that he wanted to release his forms, but he was under audit, couldn't release the forms, when in fact the IRS says that you could release them anyway. This is not about politics. This is about policy. I have very methodically, scrupulously, with great care, based upon the almost daily advice of House counsel, who incidentally has spent 40 years at the Justice Department and argued in front of the Supreme Court, they are the ones who advised me on how to proceed. This is not about entertainment. This is more about informing the American people as to how policy plays out under this section of the law that is entirely clear. It says, upon request, the IRS shall furnish those tax documents.
Representative Neal, you've emphasized this idea of voluntary participation. President Trump's administration is suing the state of California. They recently enacted a law that would require presidential primary candidates to release their returns in order to be on the California ballot. But the administration is saying, hey, a state can't preempt federal election requirements with their own. Should there be some level of federal legislation that compels candidates to release their taxes?
Well, there is federal legislation, and that's what is known as 1603. And it says that the chairman of the Ways and Means Committee, the chairman of the Finance Committee, or the chairman of the Joint Tax Committee, they can request presidential tax forms.
But what about candidates? What about candidates for the presidency?
I don't know any candidates in my recent memory who haven't voluntarily released their tax forms. I think just about all of them.
Except President Trump. So I think what I'm trying to get at is, should a candidate in the future be compelled, given that there was lack of cooperation in 2016?
Well, I think once this court case is finalized and a decision is made, I think likely legislation will flow from that judgment.
I want to ask in one other direction, Congressman. One of the questions that has split Democrats in the House and Senate is whether President Trump should be impeached. Do you feel the president should be impeached?
I think that Speaker Pelosi is handling this the correct way. She is saying that if you were to proceed with impeachment, that one of the difficulties you would have here is, recall that the House of Representatives, they essentially sit as the grand jury, and then the Senate sits as the actual jury. Speaker Pelosi, I think, has wisely said we should continue with our responsibilities of oversight and investigative authority to oversee the executive, in this case the president. But she's also pointed out wisely, I think, that you would need 20 Republicans in the U.S. Senate to vote for conviction. Not only do I not see us getting 20, I don't know where you go for the first one.
Well, that is a practical matter and understandable. The speaker has also said that President Trump has committed impeachable offenses. So has he committed impeachable offenses?
That's why she has encouraged myself, along with the other members of the key committees, the other five, to continue with our oversight responsibilities to secure the information that we need as we try to assemble that judgment.
So you don't have a judgment on that yet?
Well, I have a judgment on it. That is essentially similar to the one that she's suggesting. We should proceed with our responsibilities for oversight, see where it goes, and then make a determination.
So there's clearly at least some disagreement in the Democratic Party on this question of impeachment. Also on a number of other issues. Your primary opponent, Holyoke Mayor Alex Morse, he's just been endorsed by Justice Democrats, which is a national PAC that backed newly elected Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
Well, I don't think they really did back Ayanna. They did the other ones, but I'm not sure that they backed Ayanna. You'd have to figure that out or qualify that.
Fair enough. Given their role in getting new Congress people elected, you've been in Congress for 3 decades. You are the dean of the delegation. What's your response to those who say, listen, we've got fissures in this party and the face is changing and we have to have fresh leadership?
I think there's a judgment that comes based upon whether or not one is deemed to be effective in advocating on behalf of their constituents. And I hope that that's a record that we're going to have a chance to discuss during the course of the next many months. I'd put that record up there for scrutiny, and I hope that there can be a full-throttle discussion about it. But simultaneously, there's going to be a discussion of Alex Morris's record as mayor of Holyoke. Recall that the Holyoke Public Schools right now fell into receivership during his time as mayor, and during that period of time, he missed half the school committee meetings. That meant 28 out of 58 school committee meetings were missed. So I think that I understand how people want to discuss future campaigns and future candidates, but I'm happy to discuss the Secure Act, the IRS reform bill, the Butch Lewis Act, the Pride Act, and many of the things that I've done is I right now am in the midst of renegotiating the North American Free Trade Agreement. I think that advocacy stands up under the scrutiny, under the magnifying glass of critical analysis, and I'm happy to debate it fully, as I intend to do.
Congressman, Justice Democrats say that they did help Ayanna Pressley with her campaign. Does that change your answer to my previous question at all?
No, not really. I mean, I think that that's up to them. I was told that they weren't in at the beginning, perhaps, but that's up to them. They can make that determination, and I'm happy to have a full discussion about it. I've had a pretty, I think, successful record in Congress. I've been returned many times by my constituents, and I intend to vigorously pursue another term.
Massachusetts Congressman Richard Neal, the dean of the New England delegation, we appreciate the full discussion you had with us.
Thank you very much, and nice to be with you.
Stay with us. Coming up, we talk to two mayors whose cities have experienced mass shootings. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Today, Boston Mayor Marty Walsh and 214 mayors from across the country wrote a letter to Senate leaders urging them to immediately call the body back into session and pass bipartisan gun safety legislation. The letter is signed by both Republican and Democratic mayors, including Mayor DeMargo of El Paso, Texas, and Mayor Nan Whaley of Dayton, Ohio. It's also signed by Annapolis Mayor Gavin Buckley. Annapolis is where a gunman killed five people at the Capital Gazette newspaper last year. Rob Hyacin, Gerald Fishman, John McNamara, Rebecca Smith, and Wendy Winters. Mayor Buckley knows the pain a community can suffer firsthand, and he has a powerful message to mayors around the country as they try to think about this happening in their community.
Out of this horror, you will see the human spirit in your community triumph. And so not to give in, but to move forward, we owe it to our country to try to make this a better place.
We're going to hear more from Annapolis Mayor Gavin Buckley in just a moment, but we want you to call us. What do we need from our local leaders in times like this? How can Bostonians support other communities in moments of tragedy? Are you afraid now? You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And you can send us a tweet at Radio Boston. Mayor Gavin Buckley spoke with us earlier today. He began by telling us how he reacted after the two mass shootings this weekend.
You feel for the victims. You feel for the people who have to, the first responders that have to clean up the carnage. And then you get angry, you know, and then you go, how can we let this be the new normal?
You wrote an open letter to the communities of Dayton and El Paso in the Capital Gazette, and you said, quote, I can tell you from personal experience that your cities will never be the same. You will never be the same, end quote. How is Annapolis different now than it was before the shooting?
I think, you know, it's affected journalism in a fashion. I think, you know, younger people are questioning whether it's really worth the risk now. And our city's different because we've lost people that we all cared about. We see the journalists that dealt with that were in the newsroom at City Hall, and we know that they're never going to be the same. We know the editor of that newspaper is never going to be the same. I think that you just feel deeply for those guys more so than yourself. And then we see the first responders. I mean, these are people who run to danger when we all have to run to safety, but it's got to affect them, the trauma of that.
Mayor Buckley, I have to imagine that when you became mayor of Annapolis, you didn't particularly imagine that guiding your community through this kind of loss and grief would be part of your responsibility. How are you different today?
Look, I'm emboldened to try to do something about it. We run for office and not to be politicians, but to make a difference. And so if we can do anything to change the situation in our country, then we all have an obligation to do that. So I'm joining with other mayors together. We're going to push hard at the next mayor's winter conference. And why I think it's important for mayors to push hard on this stuff is because, you know, a lot of mayors are elected in a bipartisan fashion. It doesn't seem to be getting any traction when we blame one side or the other. But we know one thing for sure, when these shooters come into our communities, they don't see Republicans or Democrats. They just kill people, right? And so we have responsibility to our constituents and to our children and to our grandchildren to actually do something about what is happening in the country.
As part of the aftermath in Annapolis, Mr. Mayor, you actually took specific measures. Last year, you wrote in the Capital Gazette that you would be asking police to track all kinds of data related to gun violence in your community, like the percentage of crimes involving guns and if those guns were acquired legally or illegally. Has that effort led to any change in local regulations?
So, you know, it's hard to change gun laws when you're restricted federally and statewide, but I do look up to Mayor Peduto from Pittsburgh. Their city council put forward legislation, and the minute that was voted upon, the NRA and their lawyers sued them personally. So they took steps to make a stand against an organization that doesn't have a millimeter of compromise in it. I don't believe they're a credible organization, and I think you're seeing that play out in public now. They need to just do the common sense things. No one wants to stop hunters. No one wants to take away sporting rifles or anything like that. But some things are just common sense.
What's one common sense piece of legislation that you think really should immediately be passed federally?
We don't need rapid fire weapons. You can have a shotgun. You can have a handgun if that's what you need, if you believe in protecting your homestead thing or whatever it is that motivates you to need to be armed. You need to have background checks. You need to have a license to have a gun. All those things are just common sense things for good gun owners. Most gun owners agree that a background check is just should be standard. And then we can work on, I believe we should have some kind of buyback scheme nationally when it comes to rapid fire weapons or assault weapons.
Did you have these same positions on gun and gun policy before the shooting in Annapolis, or did anything change for you in terms of your attitudes towards guns after the shooting?
Yeah, I think it made me feel like I needed to do something, that I owed that to the victims to keep the pressure on, not to just give them my thoughts and prayers, but to actually step up and do something. So we had a gun summit, a Safe City Gun Summit, that not only addressed mass shootings in this city. We had a Safe City Gun Summit on the grounds of our college, which is the third oldest college in the country, St. John's College. The Founding Fathers gathered in that place. We had a Liberty Tree there. They must have talked about the Second Amendment, the Fourth Amendment, the First Amendment. You know, so, but it's ridiculous that we have these killing machines allowed to civilians. We shouldn't be allowed to have those.
Mr. Mayor, today you and your city, you know, you're offering support to other communities that have, as you say, joined a club they never wanted to be a part of. In 2013, Boston joined that club after the Marathon terrorist bombing. What is your advice to residents of Greater Boston or other cities who have sadly joined this club and who want to show up for or stand with residents in El Paso or Dayton today?
First of all, as you know, this stuff can happen to any city in the country. You are not immune to this. So whether it's extremists of any type, whether that's white supremacy or, you know, religious extremists, they're all just as lethal to our community. So we have to stand up and not make these events make us stronger and make us come together to come up with common sense solutions. What's good about mayors is that a lot of us are voting to office in a bipartisan fashion. So there has to be a bipartisan solution to this.
You have really sadly earned wisdom from your own experience. So sadly, there is a mayor somewhere now who one day is going to wake up one morning with the burden of leadership in the aftermath of an event like this. What is one thing you would say in guidance to that person facing that burden?
Look, none of us want to get that phone call. None of us see it in the manual when we sign up to be mayors, but it seems like it's coming. It seems like it's around the corner for every city. So what is going to be the tipping point? I can tell you that we did drills before the shooting at the Capitol Gazette. Wendy Winters was at that drill. I watched as we called in a shooting at the school that we were doing the drill at. The police force came through the back door. They stepped over simulated injuries. They made their way around the corner to get to the shooter where they were going to take the shooter down. And then at that point, Wendy Winters was covering that story 1 week before that actual horror actually came to her newsroom. So preparing is one thing, but really what has to happen is less guns. And mental health needs to be addressed. We need to put money into mental health because we know what we have in this country. We have a lethal cocktail. That lethal cocktail is unaddressed mental health issues with easy access to weapons. And that's the sort of reason we're seeing so much carnage.
That's Annapolis Mayor Gavin Buckley. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Call us. Boston has experienced great tragedy. What lessons have we learned through our pain that could be useful to other cities as they're trying to heal from the recent tragedies they've experienced? Arlene from Danvers, you're on the line. Go ahead.
Thank you for taking my call. As I said previously, I am so upset by everything that has gone on and continues to go on. As a Latino woman, it is frightening because clearly, you know, we're ethnic looking and you know, we are right now a target. But there are instances where it's just a mass of people. And yes, as the Annapolis mayor said, it's important that we take a look at background checks, make it a must, as well as, you know, healthcare when it comes to mental health, because if nowadays you call for a counselor or to see a mental health practitioner and it's months sometimes before you can actually get an appointment. So unless you're going through some kind of crisis, and then at that point, you know, it's scary.
Arlene, I'm so sorry for your fear. I can hear it in your voice. I'd love to have other callers join and share their thoughts and feelings right now, too. 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. We also have another voice on the line. Bobby Dyer is the mayor of Virginia Beach. In May, a city employee killed 12 people and injured 4 at a municipal building there. Mayor Dyer, welcome to Radio Boston.
Oh, hey, it's a pleasure to be on with you. Thank you.
I appreciate you joining us. You know, we just heard from Annapolis Mayor Gavin Buckley about his experience. How has your city changed since the mass shooting in May?
Well, I'll tell you, first it was a state of shock and then it's a state of grief. And now we're in the process of healing. But I can tell you that what has been overwhelming was the reaching out by, you know, not only people in our city, but from the adjacent cities, from the rest of the Commonwealth in Virginia and this country. We feel the prayers and, you know, it's the unity and, you know, in spite of this tragedy, you know, we're going to find opportunity to come together as a stronger community.
Mayor Dyer, paint that picture for us. What did that reaching out look like? What did cities do? What did communities do? Make that really clear for us.
Well, I'll tell you what, you know, just even speaking to the, you know, the mayor of Orlando and, you know, we had other things, you know, people just calling and, you know, obviously the immediate time, you know, right after the tragedy, you know, it's an overwhelming thing, but a lot of people reaching out, but there was a lot of logistics and, you know, we had to do a number of interviews to, you know, inform, you know, the public what was going on and things of that nature. But, you know, you have the grim task of, family notification and getting grief counselors on board and, you know, a tremendous amount of logistics were involved.
Mayor Dyer, as some of the logistics were handled and you moved into the next stage, what did you find was the best way as a city leader to help families of victims and the larger community begin to heal?
Well, I'll tell you what, we did a great job. We had members of our honor guard from the police and fire departments actually work with the families. And, but there's another element, too, that we have to bring up. Yes, we had 12 fatalities and 4 woundings, but we had over 300 people in the building that witnessed the carnage that went on, too, that we have to take and really embrace and, give them also a strong priority, too. And, the main thing was to get the counseling, and they got the employees together at different situations and just trying to help, because there are so many people impacted by this. It's not only the families, it's the co-workers, but it's also the community at large. And, it's an overwhelming task that we're, and it's going to be a lifelong endeavor for us. This is not a short-term situation.
Did you learn anything from other mayors who've experienced similar tragedies in their cities?
Well, I'll tell you what, I kind of sense some of the frustration because, from what I understand, Las Vegas, they're not sure why the shooter did what we did. You know, we're still looking into it. We have 2 concurrent investigations going on. And, I hate to say that some of this, where now people's family members, friends, and coworkers might be within a flash of a second, willing to do great evil and harm to fellow man is a great concern to everybody.
And have you reached out to other mayors whose cities have had mass shootings since your own?
I have calls in to San Jose and Dayton. But once again, sometimes, I appreciate the fact that they're inundated. And what I would like to do eventually is get all the mayors that have been involved. And as the previous mayor said, the club that nobody wants to join, and maybe get together and come together as a group and talk to each other and, talk about what there. Once again, there's no playbook on how to react. Our situation was unique because it was a government municipal building. But when you look around and, see the locations of what goes on with this carnage, it could be a synagogue, it could be a Walmart, it could be almost anywhere these days.
If you reach either the mayor of El Paso or the mayor of Dayton, briefly, what do you want to say?
Well, I would tell them that, what gets us through is prayer and knowing that people are out there that are caring. And then if we have to share any resources, whether it be on the response neither by our police or any of our city services, that we're here for them if we could be of service to them in any way. But once again, it's just knowing that we're coming together as a nation and as a community, to embrace the folks that they're going through this because we've been through it ourselves.
Virginia Beach Mayor Bobby Dyer, thanks for joining us on Radio Boston.
It was my privilege. Thank you.
Let's take a couple more calls. Anne from Auburn, you're on the line. What's on your mind?
Well, I just got out of the crisis stabilization unit in Worcester last evening. I checked myself into the ER because I was suicidal on July 4th, and I was begging for help.
How are you now? I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I'm concerned about our mental health system. Most of the people that I met, the other patients, were decent people, down on their luck, and having substance abuse problems. And there were plenty of programs for them. I do not have a substance abuse problem, just a lot of physical issues, and the depression just really crept up on me. Haven't worked in almost 2 years, and there is no help in the Massachusetts mental health system for someone like me who only has major depression with anxiety disorder without substance abuse. There's a trillion programs out there for people who have dual diagnoses, but nothing out there for someone like me begging for help. And they basically have nothing for us.
And I'm glad you're okay. I appreciate you calling. I'm sorry that you felt unsupported, but your call gives us an opportunity to share with other listeners an important resource, which is 1-800-273-8255. That's 1-800-273-8255. That's the Suicide Prevention Hotline. I'd like to take more calls, but we have to go to a break. Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. We've talked all week about the recent mass shootings in America. El Paso, Texas, Dayton, Ohio, last week in Gilroy, California. In the previous segment, we heard about the Virginia Beach shooting earlier this year, as well as Annapolis last summer. So many senseless killings, lives lost, families, children, parents, devastated. As a mother myself, I can barely even speak the question. If a child you loved were gunned down, could you ever find it in your heart to forgive the shooter? That is exactly the question Mom Alyssa Parker faced, and she did. She forgave her daughter's killer, Adam Lanza. Emily Parker was 6 years old when she died at Sandy Hook Elementary School in 2012, when Lanza murdered 20 children and 6 adults. Through the horror of it all, Alyssa Parker found forgiveness in her heart. She wrote about it in her book, An Unseen Angel. And she spoke with WBUR's Meghna Chakrabarty when the book came out in 2017, 5 years after her daughter's death.
It was really difficult. I had this innate motherly instinct to always keep track of, you know, all three of my kids. And holding hands was something that, you know, was a part of my job. And it was really difficult after she died while I would scramble to make sure everyone was holding a hand and somehow connecting to me as we crossed the street to recognize that there was one missing. And her hands in particular, I remember such detail about her hands. And she was this artist, and she had developed these calluses on her hand because of all of the artwork that she had created. And I missed her. I missed just connecting with her in that way.
Today, we bring you our conversation with Alyssa Parker and how Alyssa dealt with the loss of Emily and ultimately found her way to healing, to forgiveness, through her Mormon faith and through God.
I felt it almost immediately after I found out that Emily died. I remember sitting in my car with my husband, Robbie, and that was the first time we really had been alone that day, because majority of the day had been spent in the firehouse waiting for information with all the other families about our kids. And I remember sitting there with him, and it was quiet, and he decided to say a prayer. And while he was saying the prayer, I immediately heard words run through my mind, and it said that Emily was okay and that everything our family needed to get through this would be provided for. And though the moment was very brief, I felt hope. And after the prayer was over, again, I was swarmed with this grief and shock. And that hope did not last in that moment very long. But over the course of the next few days especially, I looked back on that and wondered, how is he going to fulfill that promise to me? How is he going to see this through? Because right now, the only thing that would see me through would be having my daughter come back. And so it really set the tone, though, for the conversation that I would have with him. You know, okay, you say you're going to help me. This is what I need to know. This is what I need to understand.
So what were the things that you needed to know and needed to understand?
Yeah. There was this talk at Emily's funeral that was given by one of the church leaders, And he had said something about not holding on to the life that I had seen for my daughter and to not hold on to that pain. And I was doing just that. And I thought, this is where I need help. And so I had gone to God and I prayed and I said, I will do whatever it takes to grieve the loss of the life that I saw for my daughter, but I need your help. I need you to help me see her new life. Mm. And I can see something that can somehow give me closure to that life that she will not have, that I had envisioned for her.
Yeah. And this is such a long process. Maybe journey is actually an even better word, because you write about how there's this really pivotal moment where all of a sudden you understand it, that if you're going to keep going, you needed to meet with Adam Lanza's father, Peter Lanza. How did that happen?
Now, you have to understand, when the shooting happened, the last thing I was really thinking about was my feelings and emotions towards the shooter. I was angry. He was a monster to me. And I felt okay with that for the time being. And it wasn't until my husband shared with me an interaction that he had with our daughter, Madeline, who had just turned six at the time, or five at the time, I'm sorry. When he was tucking her in for bed, she said, "When do I get to see Emily again?" And he said, "You know, when we are here on this earth, if we make good choices, when we die, we'll be able to see Emily again." And she thought about that for a minute and then said, "What about the boy who shot Emily? What happens to him?" And so my husband posed the question to her, "Well, what do you think God thinks of him?" And her response was, "I think that God still loves him, but is really sad about the choices that he made." And it wasn't until he spoke those sweet words to me that I considered looking at him through different eyes. And I resisted that feeling. I was comfortable feeling angry, and I felt like holding on to that anger was something I deserved,
yeah.
That I was supposed to feel those feelings towards him, that I wasn't supposed to let him off the hook in some way. And that conversation led us to have a meeting with the shooter's father. And I held on to this idea of, I'm going to share a message with him to inspire this father, Peter Lanza, to make some good out of this horrible situation so that we can learn from what we can about what went wrong with his son. And then the idea of hearing about his son was something that I did not want to be a part of our conversation. I wanted to say what we had to say, and that was about it. But that's not what happened. He really just started to pour his heart out about what he was going through and what he remembers. And I left that meeting seeing him again a different way.
You were also sitting across the table from another parent who had experienced a horrible loss.
And I thought to myself, you know, this is a man who's also lost his son, but lost him in a horrific way, where his son has created so much damage. And I couldn't even fathom the pain that that would inflict on me as a parent.
Yeah.
And I had a lot of empathy for his circumstances. I looked at him and I thought, that's tough.
Did you want to hold Peter Lanza more accountable? Because I'm trying to imagine what I would say if I was sitting across from the father of a shooter. And I would want to say, why couldn't you have done more as his father?
What I felt was, if you feel like I'm attacking you, I am completely taking away an opportunity to learn from what happened to you and your son. And I thought about all of those children who struggle with something similar and their parents who are desperately trying to find answers and find help for their child. And if I isolate this father and I make him feel horrible, I felt like I was turning that finger and pointing it at those parents who were struggling with the exact same thing. And that did not seem at all like the Christ-like thing to do. Hmm. I thought, if I love these children and I want to help them, I don't want to isolate them. I don't want them to feel like their struggles are their fault. I want to learn from what went wrong and see what we can do to make sure that this doesn't happen again.
Yeah. Do you mind if I ask you to read a little excerpt from your book?
Of course.
About, you know, one of the kind of transformative moments on this journey that you and your family have taken. It's the excerpt on page 139 where you talk about, you know, the more that you learn and you read about the shooter, that you reached a new place, a new understanding.
Of course. I finally came to the conclusion that I would never know. I would never fathom what was in his heart. But God could. God knew how to hold him accountable. That burden was not for me to carry. Rather, it was for me to lay down at God's feet. It was not something I needed to grapple with the rest of my life. I didn't have to judge. I didn't have to figure it out. As I made this decision, a burden so deep and so heavy it nearly crushed me was physically lifted from me. My heart burned with a joy so powerful it brought me to tears. I had learned it was possible to forgive Adam Lanza. And that first step was for me to choose to simply let it go.
That's Alyssa Parker reading an excerpt from her book, An Unseen Angel. Did it really feel like that? Like suddenly you could breathe again a little bit?
Yeah, it truly did. And what was so interesting was when I could physically feel that weight lifted off and that peace instantly replaced it. I knew that that's what Emily wanted for me.
Yeah.
I knew she wanted me to feel happy again. Mm-hmm. And it was, I think, in my desire and my, you know, my determination to find her that led me to forgive. And she knew my heart needed to heal. She knew that I needed that closure in order to be not only the person that I wanted to be or needed to be, but I was so grateful that that transition, that transformation allowed me to be a mom again.
Yeah. That's the thing about forgiveness, right? It's not just an act that you bestow on someone else,
no,
right?
No, not at all.
It's something that profoundly heals you. It's almost as if you're doing it for yourself.
Right.
But the other thing I think about forgiveness is that it's not just an end state either.
No, not at all. I think that was always my impression, that it was kind of a declaration that you then make and move forward, and that's the end. I never really thought of it as a state of being, almost a choice that I had to make over and over again. And there's days that I fail. There's days that I don't have that feeling in my heart, but I get better at it and I get stronger and it gets easier.
Well, Alyssa, I wonder if we could end with a story about Emily and the amazing, luminous little girl that she was. I mean, it's actually the place where you start the book, and you tell us how you started that day in December 2012. And Emily comes into your room and she gets you out of bed and she takes you into her room because she wanted to show you some flowers that you'd stenciled onto the wall.
Yeah. So she came over and she said she just had this most amazing thing that she had discovered. And on the back of the bed, we had stenciled these flowers, and they were her three favorite colors, black, pink, and blue. And she said, "Mom, I have the coolest thing to show you." And I said, "What?" And she said, "Look at these flowers. Do you see these two flowers?" She said, "One has a pink center with a black outside, and the other one is pink with a black inside. Do you see it? And I said, yeah. She said, they're connected. Isn't that amazing? There's connections everywhere. If you just look around the world, there's connections. Do you see it? And those words were so profound to me in the months and the years since her passing, seeing these connections and the connections everywhere. And I hear those words and the voice over and over again in my head every time I have one of those small little miracles. And I think, do you see the connections, Mom? Mm. They're everywhere.
Alyssa Parker's book is An Unseen Angel. She spoke with WBUR's Meghna Chakrabarty in 2017. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening to Radio Boston.
Wait, don't go yet.
Because you already know how to download a podcast.
But if you have any other tech or life question, maybe we can help you. WBUR is working on a new show, and we need your tech questions.
Or maybe your parents' questions. Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and leave a message. 617-917-4717.
Yes, we know. How quaint. A phone call. But give it a try. 617-917-4717.